Welcome to Health Center Radio on WBAI-FM. This is Christy Westfall, and today we're celebrating diversity in California. After two trips to D.C. in 2 months, the key theme that has emerged from my health policy travels is that the states must get local about the people's passions. Here in San Diego, California, I frequently drive past this sign at our Camp Pendleton, and it states preserving California's precious resources. My favorite thing about my state of California is our diversity, and I felt it important to do a radio segment exactly about that. Our diversity here is one of our greatest, if not the greatest, assets here in California, yet many of us are really concerned that the decisions of the federal government may be placing our precious resources at risk. Joining the show today is California District 78th Assemblymember Todd Gloria. So while the federal political landscape remains nebulous, potential lies in each of our states to get local and get loud about the issues that make our state great. So Assemblymember Gloria champions diversity here in San Diego, and he's going to share some tips with us on how he's getting local and how you are too.
Thanks for having me, Christy.
Awesome. So, gotta ask, what inspired your career in public service? How did you get here?
It's a great question. It's a long story, probably 10 podcasts long, but to condense it down, you know, I am the son of a hotel maid and a gardener, and, you know, I grew up here in San Diego. It's not an easy thing to do, even back then. California's pretty expensive then, and, you know, I think my parents taught my brother and I that you should leave things better than you found it. And that's a recipe for a career in public service. And so I have been involved in my community since I was a boy, following their good teachings. And that just sort of led to this job now where, as I tell people, I feel really fortunate because I just get to wake up every single morning and figure out a way to make our state a better place to live. And that's a pretty good job.
So now that you've been elected to the California Assembly, and I'm very excited that you are, you've been busy advocating and authoring legislation that preserves California's resources. Human rights have been on your radar, and I'd like to take a moment to talk about the T. So, yes. The Trump administration, not that team, recently rescinded the Obama guidelines to allow transgender youth to use the bathroom of their choice in public schools. Title IX is currently being reviewed and under a bit of scrutiny in terms of interpreting gender. So, California has made some local efforts to support diversity, and can you speak to some of those efforts?
Well, we've done a lot of stuff. You know, I think California certainly has been proud to be a leader in the LGBT rights movement for decades now. And really the movement has gone from the lesbian and gay men's community to one now where we're trying to work on the issues of the transgender community, the T, as you mentioned. We don't have a whole lot of help coming from the federal level. There are a lot of states for where this is really controversial. It's not necessarily an easy lift in California either, but because we have been able to do so much, I think we're able to do more. California passed a gender-neutral bathrooms, and I was proud on the city council when I was at City Hall to install the first gender-neutral bathroom in the city of San Diego in one of my communities, and we're moving forward with those efforts regardless of what the federal government does. But there's more work to be done. I think if you talk to the transgender community, you know that there are unacceptable rates of unemployment, tons of bullying and harassment, a lot of barriers that, you know, maybe some in the L and the G part of the community have transcended, but for whom the transgender community, we have not done right by them yet. And so I'm thinking specifically of new groundbreaking legislation that would add a box to forms. You know, there are male, there is a female box, and you check one or the other, but for some people that doesn't represent who they are. And in fact, for those folks who feel that way, we still make it fairly onerous to acknowledge yourself legally as a transgender person. And so the state is pursuing legislation that I believe will be enacted that would give a third box for if you don't fit either one of those two, for which, again, there are people that that's the case, and to allow those folks to get their legal documents together without having to go to a doctor to attest and affirm to the fact of who they are. I think all of us know who we are. You don't need a medical professional to tell you who you are. And this would be groundbreaking. And, you know, they say as goes California, so goes the rest of the nation. Mm-hmm. Our hope would be it starts here and goes elsewhere.
And is this part of the legislation that you co-authored with Senator Tony Atkins?
Yes, I am a co-sponsor of that legislation with my great colleague, Senator Tony Atkins. She is my predecessor in the Assembly. I have made a whole career out of following her, and I'm following her on this particular issue. She's a great leader and a groundbreaker when it comes to this kind of civil rights diversity legislation.
Fantastic. So one of the other areas in California where diversity is just very vivid is with our immigrants, our refugees, and our dreamers. So many people may not understand the difference difference between those three. Do you mind just explaining that to us?
Well, sure. They're, you know, an immigrant is someone who was born somewhere else who came here, right?
That's like my mom. Right. My mom was actually born in Germany, and she came here on a boat with my grandma and my grandpa when she was five, and they landed in New York Harbor, and yeah.
And for, with the exception of the Native American community, all of us have a story like that, right? And so that community is very much present. Of course, there's the undocumented community for whom, you know, we no longer say illegal because I think I personally believe that it's not possible to be an illegal human being. It is possible for you to come into a country without documented status or to overstay a visa, which is very common. And so we have folks who are undocumented. In many cases, they live in the shadows. And that is a problem for a variety of reasons. And then the Dreamers are perhaps the most sympathetic of that group. These are, in many cases, still minors. In every case, someone who was brought to this country undocumented as minors, and meaning to say that they didn't have any personal or legal control over that decision. In many cases, we find that these Dreamers were unaware of their status. They may not become aware of it until they apply to go to college and have to supply information that they may not have. So these are folks that are, for every, by kind of most considerations, they're Americans, right? This is the only country they know. They may only speak English. And the idea of returning them to a country they've never been to or not in a very, very, very long time is troubling. California has led on this for some time. You know, we allow Dreamers to apply for public financial aid for college, recognizing they have something to contribute to our community. And these are the very much the people who are in the crosshairs of the new administration. These, we have already seen, I think, roughly a 40% drop in requests for financial aid from students who we believe to be Dreamers because they're afraid they're going back into the shadows. They don't want to come forward and identify themselves out of fear that that may be information may be turned over to a deportation force. So we are saying to those Dreamers, we want you to continue to apply. You are legally entitled to this benefit. We want you to matriculate in California. And if someone wants to come for you, they'll have to go through us.
Wow. I love that. So, I mean, I've seen this in my practice, too, as a pediatric nurse practitioner, where I sometimes will have a child that I'm taking care of where the parents may be unclear if they're going to be able to stay in San Diego, and it's heartbreaking. So it's great that there's work being done in California to support these children because they do represent the future, and I agree with you. Human rights are human rights, and it's not a matter of alien or not. It's a matter of all of us working together and supporting each other. So,
well, Christy, I appreciate you sharing that. I actually, your story is compelling. I was talking to a teacher recently, teaches the fourth grade in an elementary school in my assembly district, talking about how they're having conversations with students that are saying that they talk to their parents and they're coming up with contingency plans should the children come home from school and their parents are gone. You know, a note by the phone that says this is who you should call. And these are the kinds of conversations that are happening in classrooms across this country, across California. And that's really terrible. You know, these children, in many cases, are American citizens. And that is a barrier to, in your case, getting needed health care. In this case, to a public education. And these are the stories that I've heard, you know, but there's many more that people wouldn't even tell me because they don't want to come forward and speak to a public official. So this is real and this is tangible and this is happening every single day under the uncertainty that has been created by the current administration.
So a third population that also is vulnerable in the current state of being with our political climate are the under-resourced population. So, I mean, I want to take a moment to just talk poverty in San Diego. San Diego has approximately 3,263,431 residents. 15.7% of San Diegans are living at the poverty threshold. 142,000 of these are children. So I heard that you were recently named as chair for the Assembly's Committee on Housing Affordability. And can you give us a little bit of a preview of the work that you're going to be doing to help these impoverished families in San Diego and in California?
Well, the committee is focused on a particular set of those under-resourced folks. You know, here in California, you know, the cost of living is admittedly very high. And that means that folks who probably in almost any other community would get along just fine struggle. You know, we have a poverty rate in the state that is quite high, almost one in four. And that's largely driven by our housing crisis. And there is a lot of discussion appropriately on those who are not housed, our homeless population, to those who could receive a public subsidy for housing, and that means are extremely poor. But what I've seen, and my background is in affordable housing, I've worked in this area for my entire public career, is that folks who actually make a decent wage now are also becoming housing insecure. It's not uncommon for me to hear from someone who's making a six-figure salary to say, I just can't make this work. I hear from employers that offer six-figure salaries but can't recruit people to come work in California. And so this committee is really trying to look at not the subsidized question. There are plenty of people working on that. Tony Atkins has an exceptional bill that I believe will become law this year that would inject about $250 million each year into the production of affordable housing. What I'm looking at are market-driven resources. For those of us that will never qualify for subsidized housing but find that we can't even afford to live here anyway. So it's a big challenge. We have to solve this. And I think that in the context of this conversation, you know, many across this country are looking to California for leadership because of what's happening in Washington, D.C. And while I'm happy to oppose ideas and policies that are detrimental or averse to California's values, I think one of the best ways that we can show leadership over the next 4 years is to solve real problems of real people. And that would start with housing affordability.
All right, we're going to take a quick break. Stay tuned to Health Cetera Radio. We'll be back. Welcome back to Health Cetera Radio. A quick shout out to the Center for Health Policy and Media Engagement at the George Washington University School of Nursing. This is Christy Westfall, and we're discussing strategies to get local on California state issues, and we're chatting with California 78th District Assembly Member Todd Gloria. So there's a lot of talk on the streets and on the Hill about healthcare reform. So as I mentioned, I'm a pediatric nurse practitioner practicing here in San Diego, and most of the patients that I take care of are recipients of Medicaid or CHIP. So we know that Medicaid serves a very large percent of children. About 50% of the recipients of Medicaid are children. And then when you divide the other piece of the pie, you've got your elderly, you've got your disabled, and you've got pregnant women. So with all the talk about per capita and block granting, which has traditionally remained kind of a partisan thing, I mean, most of us in the healthcare community believe that this should be a people thing and this should be a supporting children thing. So a lot of us are very concerned, and California's put out a couple options as to how we can protect our state. What do you have to say about that?
Well, I'm glad you're asking that question, because California, unlike some other states, has embraced the Affordable Care Act. We've implemented it through Covered California, and as a result, we have the lowest uninsured rate that we've ever had. You know, millions of people have received health insurance, and that's a good thing. And so we have probably the most to lose of anybody should the Affordable Care Act be repealed. And, you know, just in terms of numbers, it's about $20 billion to the state of California. For your listeners, you know, that's roughly 20% of our overall budget. So if it's repealed, it's probably unlikely that we could accommodate that with existing state resources. And then we'll have to make some really difficult decisions about who we would choose to cover. Do you cover the sickest, the most vulnerable? Do you reduce the level of care? These are all kinds of choices that we don't have to make currently because the Affordable Care Act is law. And I would just say that you're exactly right. In my experience, block granting and per capita has been a partisan issue, but I've been heartened by the fact that there are red states and Republican governors who actually have accepted Medicaid expansion who are also opposed to this. And I think that's exactly why the president has already failed to deliver on his promise of repealing Obamacare on day one. I think that was claimed during the course of the campaign. And they're struggling to find a replacement because, as the president acknowledged now, apparently healthcare is kind of complicated. And a lot of us sort of knew that. Glad he knows that now. And hopefully this pause has to do with the fact that he knows this, but also because it's not just Democrats in blue states like myself who are arguing against this. There's a couple of folks in the red states who understand now that they also have a lot to lose. And I would just point out, in California, it is our red congressional districts that have the most to lose if the Affordable Care Act is repealed. It is a lot of Republican members of Congress from the state of California that know that if they follow through and vote as the president may ask them to, they will have to pay a significant political price at the next election, because that means it's their constituents who will not have health care going forward. And those constituents are voters.
Very true. I think one of the things that has gone back and forth with what President Trump has said and that continues to resonate with those of us that are fans of the ACA is what's going to happen with pre-existing conditions, what's going to happen with children being extended benefits until they're 26 years of age, what's going to happen with the essential health benefits. And unfortunately, none of us know the answer. We continue to wait, and I try to remain hopeful on that. So also with healthcare, you've been recently working on some legislation to revise the current HIV criminalization laws. What does the current law state, and what are you trying to achieve in your work?
Well, I appreciate letting me talk about this because this is something I'm extremely passionate about. And, you know, in the 1980s and 1990s when the epidemic was at its height, you know, there were a lot of policies and laws that were enacted, and that was done out of fear. And when things are done out of fear, often we don't make the best decisions. Fast forward to 2017, where we have science and we have medical advances that really make that fear disappear in a lot of ways. You know, I think we understand how to prevent the transmission of HIV, and more importantly, we know how to care for those who have it. And so the laws that were passed, interestingly, provide steeper and harsher penalties for folks who have HIV. So knowingly transmitting an infectious disease is a crime, but it is a bigger crime if it's HIV. So that means that the sentencing can be longer, the penalties can be greater, it can be a felony rather than a misdemeanor. Our law says you just simply treat HIV the same as other infectious diseases. And why that's important is that I think just making it a steeper penalty, a harsher crime, sends a message to everyone that really reinforces the stigma that is in the community still to this day about HIV. And then importantly, it creates a perverse incentive for folks to not get tested. Because if you're unaware of your status, you're not necessarily held accountable to some of these laws. And so we could have situations where people are actively choosing not to be tested in order to avoid the kinds of incarceration that they could have if they did know. What we know is if we want to end this epidemic, we have to test people regularly, we have to get folks into care, and we have to expand the access to things like PrEP, which can prevent the transmission of HIV. I think that this legislation will help with that. I will tell you that this will be hard to do. Only two states in the union have done this so far. But I'm betting that California can get this done. And if we do, I think we will have done a major step forward for reducing stigma when it comes to HIV, remove this incentive to not get tested, and start, frankly, treating this as the manageable illness that it is. And make no mistake, it still would be a crime, as it ought to be, to knowingly and maliciously infect somebody with an infectious disease. It just wouldn't be any different than it is for some other diseases that, quite frankly, we don't have the same solutions for that we have with HIV today. And so this is about modernizing these laws to end stigma and stop the spread of this disease.
And what you've just talked about actually resonates. I had the pleasure of hearing the Surgeon General, Vivek Murthy, speak this week. And he spoke to needing to create a community and an environment of emotional support and compassion. And I think, above all things, we need to continue with that. And your work with this law actually helps support that nicely. So,
well, thank you. It's a great bill that deserves people's attention. And I'm happy to co-author it with Scott Wiener, who is a state senator out of San Francisco.
And what's the name of this bill?
It's a good question. It is SB 239. And, you know, that pause you hear is a little behind the curtain. You know, we introduce a lot of bills, and the numbers admittedly get confused in my mind, but I want all your listeners to know to SB 239, keep an eye on that bill. Again, if you subscribe, as I do, to the belief that as so goes California, so goes the rest of the nation, hopefully we'll be able to do this soon.
All right. So despite federal threats to California's diversity, I mean, you and many others are really working hard to preserve our diversity and our dignity. For Californians and Americans who aren't working in government or in politics, do you have any recommendations about how people can get active and set the stage to really engage and lead change on the issues that are of importance to them?
Well, it's a great question, Christine. I get this actually a lot since the inauguration, really since the election. And I'm heartened, actually. You know, I have joined my constituents at women's marches, at the airport. You know, people have been out and active in a way that I have not seen in my entire political career. And I've been involved in this game for quite a while now. In terms of what you can do, how do you take that fear and put it into something positive? You know, I think sometimes it sounds a little hokey, but it still matters to contact your elected official. I mean, I have a staff here that gets phone calls, emails all day long, every day, and I ask for that information. I make my decisions in part based upon what my constituents are saying. And so ask yourself, do you want your congressperson voting on a Muslim ban with or without your input? You know, how long does it take to simply write a quick email to your elected official and let them know where you stand? Believe it or not, that information gets enumerated and it is shared with the elected official. And so that's important. Attend a public meeting. I think we've seen people at town hall meetings across this country holding elected officials accountable for their rhetoric around ending the Affordable Care Act. And as a consequence, it has not happened yet. It doesn't mean we're out of the woods at all, but it does mean that sustained presence actually is having an impact. I think often in the 21st century, you wonder, you know, does it matter? Well, I'm here to tell you it does matter, and you should be in touch. And the last thing I would just say is that, you know, hopefully if folks need to vote, right? They need to show up and vote, and their vote does matter. And importantly, not only does their vote matter, but they matter. And so I would encourage some folks to start thinking about running for office. You know, as I mentioned before, I'm the son of a maid and a gardener. You know, I ran because often I feel like people like me and my family weren't heard in public office. We weren't necessarily heard in state capitals and in city halls. And so I've tried to use my time to give voice to that. If you feel like what you're seeing in Washington, D.C. and elsewhere is not a reflection of you and your values and what you think is right, then, you know, but certainly vote for the people you think support that. Support the candidates that you think support that. And if you don't see anybody, run yourself. The only way we can make change is by being in the arena. This is not the time to take our toys and go home. This is the time to lean in and fight.
So I think we agree that in order for America to stay great, there must be representation and respect for the people within every state. So how can we follow your work? Do you have a Twitter handle, a website, an email address that people can contact you?
I have all of those things. I like to tell people I'm the easiest person in the world to find. Just Google me. But yeah, absolutely. Follow on Twitter. Follow on Facebook. Follow on Instagram. We have a website, both official and campaign. You know, the differences on that are, you know, official is about using taxpayer resources and communicating my role as an assembly member. But we have these other ones that allow me to be a little bit freer in terms of personal opinions and whatnot. I try and interact, actually monitor them myself. And the reason for that is I want to be in touch. And I think you'd be surprised how many people are like me. I don't think I'm an exception. I think there are many members of certainly the legislature and elsewhere that pay attention and are involved. And, you know, maybe we don't respond, but you see it and you hold that with you. And so when you're sitting in that committee hearing room and you're about to take that vote, maybe I'll remember that tweet from that person that said, you know what, the Affordable Care Act has been important for me. Please do what you can to save it. Or I'm living with HIV and I feel the stigma and I want you to do something about it. These are the kinds of stories that I carry with me every single week when I go up to Sacramento. And I'd hope that a lot of your listeners would share their stories. You know, the saying is, you know, the personal is political. And it's true. There's no statistic that is more powerful than your personal story. And it's on all of us to tell your personal stories in the public realm to those elected officials so that that helps to shape the public policy that inevitably will get created. The question is, does it reflect the needs of real people or does it reflect the needs of, you know, a 70-something-year-old billionaire who doesn't necessarily know the life of
Yeah, and as researchers, we agree with you. We think that the data and the evidence makes you credible, but it's the narrative that makes you memorable. So this is Christy Westfall, and we just had a fantastic chat with 78th District California Assembly Member Todd Gloria. Thank you so much for joining the show today. We really appreciate it. Thank you for your local work, your advocacy in preserving California's precious resources. And this is a challenge to all the states out there. If you don't like what you're seeing at the federal level, as Assembly Member Gloria has stated, use your voice, speak up, get loud, and do yourselves proud.